Today is our third class in our series on Between Husband and Wife in the Bible. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. And of course, we're talking about Moshe and Tzipporah. I hope that you find these sources as exciting and riveting and as relevant as I do, because it's really, really powerful stuff, and it's meaningful stuff. And perhaps at the end, I'll remember to mention how it's so especially relevant to my own life and my relationships with my family and with my wife. I am assuming that the sources at the beginning of the source sheet you went over rather well, whereas the sources at the end of the source sheet you hardly got to or didn't see at all. So therefore, in the class, I'll spend more time at the end and less time at the beginning to make sure that we do wrap everything up well as we should. So, beginning at the beginning of the source sheet, that source from Yalkut Shimoni that everyone began with, we won't read it inside because, again, I think that you've had a chance to digest it well in Haruta. That source, to summarize it outside, says something absolutely flabbergasting, that Moshe, and at this point he was not yet Moshe Rabbeinu, but he was going to be someday Moshe Rabbeinu, the man that was someday going to be Moshe Rabbeinu, at an early point in his life, was, to use mild language, was rather wishy-washy about his Judaism and his Jewish identity. He was willing to make a deal to get the girl he wanted to marry. He was willing to say, okay, the first child would be for idolatry. No, that's like saying in a mixed marriage that, okay, we'll send one kid to Roman Catholic parochial school and the next rest of the kids we'll send to Sunday school. We'll divide, and some of the kids will be Jewish, some will be Roman Catholic, and everyone will be happy. Obviously, that means that the Jewish identity of Moshe Rabbeinu was not that well developed at this point in his life. Let's remember how old he was. He had just fled from Egypt to Midian, and as we'll see in the verses in another few minutes, the point at which he fled in his life seems to be the point at which he was developing his identity. So he must have been 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, something like this. He's really at the beginning of his path in life, and he doesn't really know how much of a Jew he is. He doesn't seem to be that concerned about it. That's according to the Midrash.
Not a Midrash that was here, but isn't the one to the effect that, you know, he spent, I don't know, 30, 40, some number of years in Cush being their king, and only after that came to Midian. Uh-huh. So that in fact he was at least 40.
Well, when he came back to only after that he went to Midian.
Yeah, and he was there for 40 years.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's certainly not in the Torah. Could be.
On the other hand, it's based on the calculation of his age when he came back.
He was 80 when the Exodus happened,
yes,
and it says he was 40.
80.
Where does it say he was 40 when he went into Egypt?
It does not say that. It says he was 80.
I mean, into Midian.
When the whole Shlichut
led them out.
He was 80, yes.
Yeah, with the Exodus.
So I would say, befashtut, simply speaking, that approximately from the age of 17 or 20 or 21 until 80 or 79, he was in Midian. He was in Midian. Now that does bring up some questions, because if he got married at the age of 18, how was he circumcising his sons 60 years later?
I don't think it was that early that he was... I think he was in...
Right, that's one of the reasons why the Midrash says what it does. But in any case... Let's try and stay as much as possible with the framework of the Psukim and the framework of the Midrashim that we have here. As I've said in the past, I don't have the self-centeredness and the conceit to say that I'm teaching you the truth. I'm teaching you one possible truth, one refraction of many different, of shivim, of 70 different possibilities within Torah. And I admit that there are many midrashim I don't know, and there are many midrashim I know and didn't bring. I brought midrashim that go in a certain direction, develop a certain sense of who Moshe was, as I think seems to be in accord as far as possible with what I think is the Pshuto Shel Mikra, the simple, basic direction of the Psukim. I could be wrong, and there could be other directions. There certainly are other directions. Let me point out that if it's true And we'll try and develop this. If it's true that Moshe Rabbeinu, before he was Moshe Rabbeinu, had a rather weak Jewish identity and was willing to raise at least one of his children for dedicated to Avodah Zarah, that means that when Moshe Rabbeinu eventually does become Moshe Rabbeinu, well, we would call him, to use modern language, we'd call him a Baal Tshuva. Right?
Mm.
And I think that we can understand a lot about who he was using that lens and through that perspective. When I just said a minute ago that Moshe Rabbeinu was willing to dedicate at least one child to Avodah Zarah, well, why did I say just one? The Midrash says the first one for Avodah Zarah and the others for a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Say it again?
L'shem Shemayim.
Shem Shemayim. So why did I say that it's at least one? Because I'm saying to myself, if Yitro, his father-in-law, said to Moses, the first one, Avodah Zarah, the rest of them can be L'shem Shemayim, then I'm thinking that what Yitro is thinking, the first, and then Moshe Rabbeinu will be living among the Midianites, he'll be less and less connected to his people, and probably the second, the third, and the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth will also be Avodah Zarah. It never says here that he raised the first for Avodah Zarah and the second L'shem Shemayim. Only they made a deal that the first has to be L'Avodah Zarah. And under those circumstances, and in this culture, in this environment, we could assume that if the first goes to Avodah Zarah, then the second, the third, and the fourth, and the fifth might also. In any case, what I'd like to do now is go back in time and try and see the context and the social conditions under which Moshe Rabbeinu grew up that would facilitate this type of very weak and tenuous Jewish identity.
Hmm.
So to talk about the education of Moshe and the identity of Moshe as a young child, we first want to talk about the Jewish society in which he grew up. So Am Yisrael had been enslaved in Mitzrayim at this point when he was born, something like 210 years minus 80. Not 150 years, approximately 130 years. Let's think. When they went down to Egypt, Shivim Nefesh, 70 souls, the sons of Yaakov, they were certainly part and parcel of the heritage of Avram and Yitzhak, but the Torah hadn't been given. There wasn't a system of mitzvot. There wasn't a well-defined behavior system and belief system. What happened to their tradition, to their Judaism, to their historical memories of Abraham and Yitzhak and Eretz Yisrael? What happened to those memories in Mitzrayim? Well, we don't know. Sefer Shemot doesn't say. But there's a verse in the book of Yechezkel that says black and white. Black and white. And that verse is brought by the Midrash in Shemot Rabbah. We could just as well open it in the Tanakh, but let's see it here through the eyes of the Midrash. In Shemot Rabbah it says, V'chein ata motze l'Yisrael, and so you find concerning Yisrael, shayu Mitzrayim, when they're Mitzrayim, hayu ovdim avodat kochavim. They worshipped idolatry. V'lo hayu ozvim ota, and they didn't leave it. Not only did they worship idolatry, but the first time that a Kodesh Baruch Hu sent Moshe to ask them to leave idolatry, they didn't. And it brings the verse from Yechezkel, and there's four or five verses there. The Midrash only brings one. Ish et shikutzei einehem lo hishlichu. Every person, the abominations of his eyes, he didn't put aside. That's even when a Kodesh Baruch Hu asked them, as it were, to put aside idolatry, they didn't. So they were steeped in idolatry. That's what the Midrash claims. And this other Midrash from Yalkut Shimoni, that's on the beginning of the book of Shemot, when it says that Jewish people filled Mitzrayim. So the Midrash says, what does that mean? It means, Shenit malu batei tarteot ubatei karkeseot behem, that the theaters and the amphitheaters were filled with these Israelites. And for the Midrash, that's a symbol of assimilation, being part of the fabric of the site in which you live, the going to the concerts and to the discotheques and to everything that's happening there, everything that's happening there. And then the third Midrash that says, and I'll just read the last line of Shemot Rabbah in Parsha Hay, the last line, about eight words, Shemit Yosef Heferu Brit Milah. Amru niyeh ke Mitzrayim. When Yosef died, they cancelled the covenant of Brit Milah, and they said, let's be like all the Mitzrim. It is true that there's a certain strand in Midrash that says very different than these Midrashim. It says that they kept their traditions, they kept their language, they kept their clothing. But I think this is the major strand in Midrash. And in any case, it really doesn't matter, major or minor. That's the one that I think fits in with the picture we're trying to build here. So the point is that even if Moshe Rabbeinu had grew up in a quote-unquote normal Jewish household under these circumstances, he wouldn't have gotten that much of a Jewish education. If they're not keeping Brit Milah, and if they're not worshipping the one God but rather idolatry, well, how much of a Jewish identity could there really be? But Alechad Kama Vachama, all the more so in the case of Moshe, who didn't grow up in a Jewish family at all, but grew up in the house of Paro. I mean, how many years did he spend in his family? The verses tell us he spent the years until he was nigmal, until he was weaned. And then he spent the rest of his formative years in the house of Paro. So how much did he know his mother? For 2 years, from the age of 0 to 2, perhaps he was weaned at the age of 3, so 3 years, how much of a Jewish identity, how much Jewish education could he actually have gotten? So he gets to the house of Paro, and he's raised there, I assume, as an Egyptian. Hmm. He wouldn't have been raised as a Jew.
No.
Now, given that he's raised by Bat Paro, he probably got a pretty good Egyptian education. Hmm. There are even those who like to theorize, I'm not talking about Midrashim, I'm talking about some modern authors that say he must have been perhaps groomed to be even the next Paro, or to be in the courts. He was in the aristocracy. He probably got a very good Egyptian education, and we would ask ourselves, if he even remembered who his mother was, that he knew from the age of 0, 1, 2, 3, how much of a sense of Judaism, of a Jewish identity, did he really have when he was 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old? Did he even remember that he was a Jew?
But if the Jewish population anyways was so shtupt in Avodah Zarah, then why is it such a conflict? Meaning like, it isn't really a conflict. The Jews are like the Mitzrim, and he was raised like a Mitzri, so wrote Mitzri.
So, that's a good question. I would assume that there is, if not a great religious difference between the two groups, there's certainly an ethnic difference. And there's the Egyptians, and then there's the slaves. And Moshe Rabbeinu, as he's growing up, asking the following, even if, as is probably the case, he didn't have a strong Jewish identity and certainly didn't have strong Jewish beliefs or customs. Like you said, even his people didn't. But there were two separate peoples here. Jews, let's not call them Jews, Israelite slaves and Egyptians. And I could have thought that he had no connection to the Israelites, age 12, age 13, age 15, age 17, except for the fact that the Pasuk says explicitly that he considered these slaves his brothers, right? Let's look at that verse. That verse, what is it, in chapter 2 or chapter 3? I don't remember.
So obviously somewhere down the track, he knew.
He knew. It seems pretty clear that he knew that he was of Israelite stock. So let's go to chapter 2, verse Yud Aleph, 11. An important verse. Vayehi, and this is chapter 2, verse 11. Shmot Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayehi bayamim ahem, and it was in those days. Vigdal Moshe, and Moshe grew and matured. V'yitzei el Echav, and he went out to his brethren. V'yar v'sivlotam, and he saw their suffering. So I try to imagine what's happening in the mind of the young, impressionable, aristocratic Moshe Rabbeinu. And I would think that he's getting older, it says. He's deciding, thinking, hesitating, weighing, who is he? Does he have any connection to these people who he's been told are his brethren? Or is he just a Mitzri like he's been raised for the past 15, 16 years? And he goes out to see, goes out to decide. He goes for year on year course to decide, you know, who is he? What's his identity? He might be about the same age as many people in this room who are deciding who you are. And what does he see? He sees a people suffering. And has to decide, is he with them or is he with the oppressors? And as is the reaction of many people that age, he naturally sides with the underdog. And so what does the verse say? V'yar b'sivlotam, he sees them suffering. V'yar ish mitzri make ish ivri me'achav. So it's the second time that the people who are suffering are his echav, his brothers. He sees an Egyptian torturing, as it were, hitting a brother. V'fen ko v'cho v'yar ki ein ish v'yachat emitzri v'yitmenehu b'chol. So on the spur of the moment, he looks left and he looks right, and he sees that no one is looking, no one will discover him, and he kills the Egyptian. By the way, there's one person who did see what he did. Who is it? According to the Pshat.
According to that one of the Hebrew men.
The one who's being tortured sees what he does. That's going to be very important in another 2 or 3 minutes. So at this moment, clearly, I skirt them with decision. Moshe Rabbeinu throws in his lot with the Jewish people, with Echav. He can no longer go back to the palace of Paro, at least not with the same consciousness. Now, perhaps no Egyptian saw what he did, but he has on his mind that he killed one of the Egyptian taskmasters. So he now certainly has a lot of his marbles in the basket of the Jewish people, even if he's going to go back to the palace and act like a Mitzri.
And also the fellow that he saved from the sedition taskmaster, he could have spread it all around. Oh, I was just saved by...
Which he did. Yeah. Which he did. Because, yes?
No, do we have to assume that he was like familiar with what was going on? Because to think that this young person just goes out, he sees somebody being tortured and he kills a man, I mean, he had to have known a little bit, had some kind of feeling before he... This couldn't have been the first time he walked outside and saw what was going on. He had to kind of have a decision in his mind of what side he was on to actually go and kill somebody.
I don't know. I'll just say that it could certainly be, as I'm presenting it, that he doesn't know, that he has a mixed identity. He's torn. But when he sees suffering, when he sees injustice, that galvanizes him to make a decision. I can certainly see that as being quite plausible.
We said that Moshe had an Egyptian education, Paro's half. But if Paro enacted a sort of genocidal policy against the Israelites, and you have to think that there was some kind of indoctrination along those lines, a la like German or Arab phenomenon that we know in modern times, there had to have been some kind of systemic propaganda or something that he was exposed to.
I think you're probably right. And still he knows inside from somewhere that he has these Israelite roots and he is conflicted until he makes this final decision. But it turns out not to be a final decision at all. So he goes back to the palace, right? And he comes out again the next day. V'yitzeh b'yom ha'shini v'hinei shnei anashim ivrim nitzim v'yomar l'rasha lama takeh re'echa ויאמר מי שמך לאיש שר ושופט עלינו, הלהרגני אתה אומר כאשר הרגת את המצרי, ויאמר אכן נודע הדבר. The second day he goes out, and it turns out that word is out, that he did what he did yesterday. He killed an Egyptian. And there's only one way that the word would have gotten out. If it said earlier that he had turned left and right and saw there's no one looking, the only person who saw what he did, of course, is the Jew that he saved. And that Jew has now gone and spread the rumor, spread the word, and as we see further on, the word gets to Paro's house and the police put out a warrant for his arrest. Which means that the Israelites have stabbed him in the back. He was conflicted. He didn't know who he was. He decided to throw his lot in with the Jews. And it turns out that in doing so, they now stab him in the back. And just think, what does he feel right now? He's decided to throw his lot in with the Israelites, and the Israelites don't want him. They've spread rumors about him, causing him to become a fugitive from Paro. He can no longer go back to Egypt to be an Egyptian. They don't want him. He's on the wanted list.
Yeah.
So Moshe Rabbeinu becomes a man without an identity. Mm-hmm. Until now, he's a man of conflicted identity. A man, if you will, of two countries. Now he's a man of no country. No one wants him. The Egyptians don't want him. He's been rejected by the Jews who've stabbed him in the back. He becomes a person without a country, without an identity, without a sense of who he is. And that explains completely what happens to him in Midian. Midian becomes an adopted home for him, becomes an adopted identity. Because he's not an Egyptian and he's not an Israelite. He's no one. And it's no pele, it's no wonder, it's no surprise that he agrees to marry Tzipora, and even if you will, as the Midrash says, to decide to raise his children as Roman Catholics, as the prevailing religion, because that's all he has. He's adopted the Midianite land and been adopted by the Midianite land. And that's who he is right now. And just one more sentence before questions. And he lives in Midian. He lives in the house of Reuel, as you know, who's a Kohen, who's a high priest to idolatry. That's the verses, that's not a Midrash. He lives in Midian, he lives in a land of idolatry. He lives with Zipporah, a Midianite princess, for approximately 60 years. That's a long, long time, from the age of 18 or 19 or 20, until he's 80 or 79 years old, about 60 years. Most of his life, he lives out as Moshe the Midianite. Okay, so Martha and then Margalit.
Well, it could be that the original Jew who was saved, or Bnei Israel who was saved, spread good things and said, oh, this wonderful guy came and saved me.
Yeah.
And then when he gave Mussar to Dathan or Abiram or whoever it was, said, oh, I have this information. I'm going to use it against him. Could be only the one was the...
Yeah, that could be. But whatever it is, it's the Jews that brought the word to the authorities. Or a Jew that brought the word to the Secret Service.
I'm not sure where I got it from, but I thought he was in Egypt for 40 years, Midian for 40 years, and then 40 years leading them in the wilderness. When he died.
There could be midrashim that I don't know, that I'm not using, but what we have in the verses is that at this point of identity development, which I'm assuming is at adolescence, that says when he grew older, these things happened in Mitzrayim, which caused him to flee. And next thing we know, it's only when he's 80 that he leaves Midian.
Yeah.
That's 60 years.
Not a warning.
Margalit.
Question. There was no Esther at that time, not Jewish.
Right, that's a good point. The Torah had not been given. We don't know from the pshat of the Torah exactly what type of customs and what the degree of belief there is. There's Brit Milah.
So, Brit Milah was given ready to offer. Right, so but that's, like, we see that they all married. Like, Yosef didn't marry. And also, I don't feel like that necessarily defines him as identifying with Midian. Like, I remember learning that he was in Midian, and I think, like, he chose the profession of a shepherd because he wanted, like all the, a lot of the leaders of the Jewish people were shepherds so that they can communicate with Hashem.
But also, his father-in-law was a shepherd, and that's all
right,
there was to do there.
That doesn't mean that everyone had to be a shepherd.
Let me just point out, though, that at the time of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, there were very few, quote-unquote, proto-Israelites for a man to marry. They married out, that's who there was to marry. Even though, of course, Abraham did have a wife from his family, and Yitzhak did have a wife from his family, and Yaakov did have a wife from the same
stock. But not their maidservants. Yaakov married the other two.
But if we now go after Yavot, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, to the Shivim Nefesh, the 70 souls that went down to Egypt, who multiplied to a group of approximately 2 million, well, now, when there's so many proto-Israelites or proto-Jews, to marry out is a different story, because now there's a large pool, there's an ethnic group, there's a nation that's been created.
And Aharon,
to marry out of it, that's already a statement, I think. I would suppose that most of those slaves, those proto-Israelite slaves, married other proto-Israelite slaves. Mm-hmm. To marry an Egyptian?
I don't think so.
Right.
And he married out.
There was no Israel.
There was no Israel. I don't... Okay. The Torah wasn't given yet. Right? Although, of course, we do have Midrashim that the Avot kept the Torah. But from what we have in the Torah Shebichtav...
And the secret twin sisters and all that.
Okay.
Because outside of Israel, like, the whole thing was that they kept the Torah in Israel. But outside of Israel, they didn't. Like, you know, that Yaakov...
Okay, that the Ramban says that they kept the Torah
Moshe
in Israel.
Moshe wasn't in Israel.
But again, Pshat is, there was no Torah. Yet. Yet. Okay. Let's go on to... the Sneha Boer. The burning bush. We know that five times HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked, requested, beseeched, cajoled, and tried to convince Moshe to take upon himself the mantle of leadership to lead the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim. And Moshe refused. And refused. And refused. And refused. And I like to think that given the things we've discussed for the last 15 minutes, it's much easier to understand why Moshe refused. Just think. Just think if you were in his position. If you were a young person who had gotten a very weak Jewish identification, Jewish identity, grown up in a non-Jewish household, had made a certain point, at a certain point, made a decision to check out your Jewish identity, and then had been rejected by the Jews. Knife in the back at Moshe got. And then you spent 60 years of your life living in, I don't know, in India or in Thailand or someplace out in the Midwest. No connection to Jews, no connection to Judaism, married, children, everything is fine. And suddenly you hear a voice, you have a dream. And in the dream you hear God saying, go to Nicaragua and bring democracy to the people. Where is it? What are you talking about? What connection? Why me? Why should God come to me, says Moshe? What's my connection? Believe in him. Who is he? Jewish? Israel? Mesorah? Tradition? Never heard of these things. And he starts thinking back in his mind, I learned something 60 years ago, but I was rejected. That's not me. That's not who I am. And he says to God, are you crazy? Why me? I'm the last person in the world. And God comes back and says yes, and Moses says no, and yes, no, yes, no. And remember one of the passages Moses says, if I'm going to go, how should I present this God to the people? What is his name? Mm. The question is really not just how should I present him? Well, God, who are you? I have no connection. Why should it be me? And I want to point out, at the very end of the burning bush, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, does it end with a yes or with a no? Yeah. Who has the last word?
Hashem.
Moses never says yes. It ends without him saying yes. He remains steadfast in his refusal. Let's look at those verses. At the end of, what is it, chapter 3, after all the yes, no, and the yes, no, so we come down to Kodesh Baruch Hu's final statements in verse 10, 11, 12, 13, and you notice it ends with the Kodesh Baruch Hu trying to convince him. But Moses never says yes. The last verse is, and thou shalt take this rod in thy hand with which thou shalt do the signs. And Moses never says, okay. And I can just imagine that he's still conflicted. The dream ends, the encounter ends, the experience ends, and Moshe asks himself, what am I going to do tomorrow? Go or not?
Do you have any good explanation as to why did Hashem choose him?
So I'll say parenthetically that I think exactly what we're saying is the reason he chose him. In other words, it's only a man who grows up without a Jewish identity and has to struggle over it and find it and adopt it, he is apparently the best person to become the leader of the people. The person who doesn't receive it from his parents, the person who doesn't take it for granted, the person who discovers it for himself, that apparently is the man who must be the future leader of the Jewish people.
But he didn't discover it himself. Hashem appeared to him in the burning bush.
Okay, but he has to make the decision. He has to decide to become an Israelite or not. Because he can go back to Midian and ignore that dream.
But also, he didn't grow up with slave mentality.
And that's another good point. That's another good point. Didn't grow up with the slave mentality, I admit. Yep. Right. From that point of view, and from also the religious identity point of view, he is different than all the other Jews. Right.
Do you want to? This plays into, I mean, the aspect of humility, right? So you know that no one was as humble as Moshe.
There's humility here.
And
there's a sense having, a little bit of being an outsider.
Yeah, and also like having a Kadosh Baruch Hu will reveal himself in such a miraculous way at such a point in his life where basically he would have lived his life and that would have been it. It would maybe have grandkids. It would be, you know, very simple life. And it says that his tongue was heavy, that he couldn't speak. Like there were problems with how he was living his life. He was obviously in some way unfulfilled.
How do you know he was unfulfilled?
I would read it like, I mean, when he talks about his whole mouth being heavy, like he couldn't talk, some people say, right, that he couldn't communicate, he had higher ideas, but he couldn't even put them into words. He had a sense that the world wasn't as it appeared. He understood that he couldn't
could
speak
be, out. It could
but
be,
but the funny
but
thing is,
not,
was,
doesn't say that. Could,
he
could
was
be.
Actually no. Raised in Egypt. He had all that training. He would have jolly well known how to speak to them. He would have been better equipped, but he's saying, oh, but I'm slow of speech, and I can't talk. And it's like, okay, well, send Aaron. But, I mean, Hashem wouldn't have told him to do it if he couldn't. I think he could have.
Well, he did. In the end, he did.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
That's the story of the Jewish people, though. Hashem says, do something less, and we come.
Mm.
And we overcome. This after Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu goes back to his father-in-law after the encounter at the Sneh HaBoer, the burning bush.
Mm.
And we're reading those verses here in chapter 4, verse 17. And Moshe went and returned to Yetzer, his father-in-law, and said to him, let me go, I pray thee, and return to my brethren who are in Mitzrayim, and see where they are still alive. He calls them his brethren. So he has a certain stance and he's made a certain decision that he sees his fate and their fate as intertwined. But also on the other hand, he says something to his father-in-law and there's something he doesn't say to his father-in-law. He doesn't say to his father-in-law, God spoke to me and I'm going back to Mitzrayim to take them out of Egypt. He says, I'm going back to see where they're still alive. So you can say he says that to his father-in-law because his father-in-law wouldn't believe him if he said God spoke to me. But you could also say he says it because he himself is still conflicted. Mm. He says, I'm going to see. Let's see what happens. Perhaps I'll take them out of Egypt. Perhaps I won't. Perhaps I'll come back here. Perhaps I won't. He doesn't know what's going to happen. And I also want to point out that it says he took his wife and his sons in verse 20 and sent them on an ass and turned to the land of Mitzrayim. Moses took the rod of God in his hand. There are those who say, this is not necessarily the pshat, there are those who say that he took the rod of God in his hand as an afterthought. It's the last thing it says. Can you imagine? He's saying to them, should I take it, should I not take it? Am I going to do this, am I not going to do this? Am I crazy? Who am I? And in the end he takes the rod with him. But it's not clear, at least it's not clear to me, if he is certain or not, if he's going to do what God asked or not. And all of that, in my mind, is background to the two famous enigmatic verses of Vayehi Bederech Lemalon at the hotel. All this matter of conflict of identity and development of sense of self is all what is behind the story of the Malon. So we're now in Chapter 4, verse 24, Chaf Dalet. I'll read it very slowly and in Hebrew. Dalet Chaf Dalet, 4:24. Vayifkashehu Adonai, vayivakesh hamito. And God met him and requested to kill him. Unbelievable. Impossible to fathom. God met him. He's on his way back to Mitzrayim. He gets to some Malone, to some inn. He's on the way, and God wants to kill him. But Tikach Tziporah Tzrur, and she took, Tziporah took a rock, a sharp flint rock, V'tichrot et Orlat Bena, and she cut off the foreskin of her son. I assume that's the son that wasn't circumcised because he was dedicated to Avodah Zarah. And even if you don't accept the Midrash literally, it means that Moses didn't give a Jewish education to his children because he himself wasn't so sure how Jewish he is. And even if he made a decision now to go back to Egypt and perhaps to listen to God and become the leader of the Jewish people, that's only recently. His children grew up as Midianites. They certainly weren't circumcised.
They're 60 years old, according to the way we're reading it.
Yes, that's a problem. But it could be that there were further children who were born later. I don't know. Anyway, Tziporah, as Moses is in his death throes, he's being attacked by God, Tziporah takes a flint rock and cuts off the foreskin of her son, Vatiga Liraglav, and she throws it at his feet. Whose feet? It's not clear. At the child's feet or at Moses' feet? I'm going to prefer the interpretation that's brought in the Ibn Ezra, it's on the sheet, that it's Moses' feet.
Yeah.
Moses. She throws the foreskin at Moses' feet, V'tomeh, and she says, Ki chatan damim atali, which literally means, because you are a bridegroom of blood to me. Speaking to Moshe, she threw it at his feet, she's speaking to him, she says to her husband, we are wedded in blood, a bridegroom of blood you are to me. And then Vayareth Mimenu, and he released his hold upon him, meaning that God put an end, God ceased trying to kill him, whatever that means. Va'az Amra, then she said, Chatan Damim Limulot. Chatan Damim, a bridegroom of blood, Limulot. What that means, not clear at all, I'll leave it for another 5 minutes. So, let's try and make some sense of these verses. We'll look at the Ibn Ezra, we'll look at the Midrash, and then I'll try and add what I have to say to it. So if we look at the Midrash, first, in the Yalkut Shimoni at the bottom of the page, it continues the Yalkut Shimoni up above and repeats the same story about the one son being dedicated to Avodah Zarah. And then it says in the last line, L'fitach hikdim hamalach larob et Moshe. That's why the malach, the angel, came to kill Moshe, because of the one son he dedicated to idolatry. So what that's saying to me is that God, whatever that means, and we'll talk about it, is attacking Moshe because of Moses' weak Jewish identity, because of the conflicted nature of his sense of self, because he was willing to dedicate his children to give his Jewish a non-Jewish identity and education. Because of that, God is trying to kill him. I don't know what that means yet, but that's what the Midrash says. And then we turn the page.
We also thought of something else.
You know what? I'm going to continue my thrust here. So I'm going to turn the page, and I'm not going to look at the Midrash at the very top. I'm going to go down to the Ibn Ezra, the Middle Age commentary of Rav Avram Ibn Ezra. And in the second line, he says, V'tiga l'raglav, v'fi dati l'raglei Moshe. She threw it at his feet. In my opinion, it's the feet of Moshe. Kiderech, just like, and he brings a verse, V'ra'a hadam ala mashkof, v'lo yiten ha-mashkit. And it, or he, will see the blood on the mashkof, on the doorpost, and will not give the angel of death permission to kill. This goes back to, this verse is from the last plague of the 10 plagues, the plague of the firstborn, when there was a mitzvah of the Korban Pesach, to take the Korban Pesach, the sacrificial lamb, sacrifice it, put the blood on the doorpost, and it said any house that has the blood on the doorpost, their firstborn will not be killed, whereas Egyptian houses that don't have the blood on the doorpost, their firstborn will be killed. Let's think why the Ibn Ezra brings that verse here. To give a little bit of background, can't give the whole thing, but I'll say something. It's pretty clear, only from the Torah it's clear that the sheep and the lamb were the gods of the Egyptians. And when the Jewish people commanded to slaughter the Korban Pesach, the sheep or the lamb, and to burn it on an open fire, the whole animal together, which makes a lot of noise and a lot of commotion, a lot of smoke, and then take the blood and put it on their front doorpost, it would be equivalent to being commanded to take the American flag in America, burn it on your front lawn, and smear the ashes on your doorpost. In other words, the Jews, as we said, were idolaters to a large degree. And they're being told by God, make a decision. Who are you? Are you with the Egyptians? Or are you with the Jewish people? Are you with God? I want you to take the God, the sheep, the lamb that you've been worshipping, and kill it. I want you to repudiate the gods of Mitzrayim, and I want you to do it in front of all the people, burn it on your front lawn, and put the ashes, put the blood on your doorpost. And the question is, am I going to do it? Am I going to risk my life? The Egyptians might stone me. Am I going to risk my life to close the door on my Egyptian entity and open the door to a new identity? Or am I going to not do it and stay with the Egyptians? And only those Jews who put the blood on the doorpost were saved. Those who didn't weren't. It was a matter of deciding which identity is mine. And that's why the Ibn Ezra brings that verse, an explanation of our story. Because he understands that this matter of Tzipporah doing Brit Milah to her son was a moment of decision, a moment of deciding which side we're on, who are we, not deciding are we Midianites or are we with the Israelites.
And Tzipporah decided...
Yeah, I'm about to get to that. Just let me look at all those different sources here. Let's look at the Midrash Rabbah. The Midrash Rabbah in the fourth line, after the comma, fourth line, the fifth word of the line, Amra hatani tiye ata netuni b'skut damim halalu shel milah. She said, and we're explaining that line, hatan damim atali, you are my bridegroom of blood. The Midrash Rabbah explains it as Chatani Tiyata, you will be my groom, neptunely given to me, v'schut damim halalu shel milah, because of the schut, the merit of this blood. But she sees herself as becoming rededicated to her husband through this act of Brit Milah. Remember, it was because of her, as it were, according to the Midrash, that the child wasn't given a Brit Milah, that the child was raised non-Jewish, because that was the condition of her father for them to get married. The woman who, as it were, drew him away from any Jewish identity is now the woman who's saying, we're going to become rededicated to Jewish identity through this act of Brit Milah to her son. She is actually reversing the past and deciding, as Zimra was about to say, deciding for her husband and for her whole family who we are. We're certainly not Egyptians, we're not Midianites anymore, we are people of the covenant. We're people of the Brit Milah. And I'd like to add another element to this whole thing and wrap up this part of what we're talking about. This Midrash Haggadah here, I want you to look at the beginning of it. It's unbelievably pregnant with meaning. Vayhi b'derech b'malon. And it was on the way in the inn. And the Midrash says, im derech lama malon. If they're on the way, why does it say they're in the hotel? And if they're in the hotel, what is on the way? It's either you're walking on the way or you're encamped for the night. It can't be both. I understand it could be that they're on the way and they camp for the night, but the Midrash sees a conflict here, and its answer is, Ela milamed shaya Moshe nichnas v'yotze. Rather, it teaches you that Moshe was coming in and going out. Mimalon l'derech, miderech l'malon. From the inn to the street, from the street to the inn. Bayam meharher bedato, and he was thinking in his mind, Roman, saying, "Im yilech leMitzrayim ligolat Yisrael im lav, if I'll go to Egypt to redeem Yisrael or not." Now the Midrash goes on to say something that I'm not going to adopt. I just want to work with this image for a moment. This is the image of a man who can't sleep at night. It's the image of someone who wakes up and paces back and forth, back and forth, because he has a very difficult decision to make, and he can't decide what to do. A decision that his whole life depends upon, and he doesn't know what he's going to do because he doesn't know who he is. I want to now give a psychodramatic interpretation of the things we've seen for the past 10 minutes. I would like to go back to the question, what does it mean that God tried to kill Moshe? And I think the only way I can understand it is that God is trying to kill Moshe in the sense of a psychodrama. Moshe Rabbeinu is conflicted. He was conflicted when he was 18. He was conflicted when he was 20. He lived a life since then of a pastoral, nomadic, happy existence. He was satisfied. And suddenly, this skeleton from his closet, this voice comes out of the burning bush and says, I want you to become the leader of the Jewish people. And he says, you're crazy, I can't do it, I don't know what's going on. And they go back and forth, five times at the burning bush. And at the end, God leaves, and Moses still doesn't know what he's going to do. And then he picks up his whole family, he tells his father-in-law, I'm going back to Mitzrayim to see if my brethren are still alive, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. And they're on the way to Mitzrayim, and they get to a certain inn at the entrance to the country, and he can't sleep at night because he doesn't know who he is, he doesn't know what he's going to do. Should I go back to Midian and forget the whole thing? Should I go through with this? What's going to happen with me? What is this God? Who are these people? Why am I doing this? And he is about to die. He literally feels that he can't sleep, he can't live another moment because he doesn't know who he is, and he doesn't know what's going to be the next moment. What should he decide? And he gets up at night in a cold sweat. He walks, paces back and forth, outside, inside, and then his wife wakes up, sees what's going on, and instinctively, she solves his dilemma in one moment. She picks up this flint rock. She goes to their son, uncircumcised son, circumcises the boy, takes the foreskin, throws it at Moses' feet, and says, Hatan damim atali, you are wedded to me through blood, through the blood of Brit Milah, which means to say, we have now decided who we are. We are of the mulot. We are of the people who are circumcised. She has decided for him in one fell swoop what the identity of her husband is and what the identity of the family is. And the truth is, it reminds us of stories we hear all the time of women who convert to Judaism, marry a Jewish man, and end up bringing that man back to Judaism. They end up determining the identity of the family unit through this decision. And it's a decision of danger. It's a decision of blood. Right? But she goes through with it. And it turns out, so it seems to me, that Moshe Rabbeinu becomes Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe becomes Rabbeinu only through the skut, through the merit of Tzipporah, who decides for him who he is at a moment that he could not decide himself. And that's powerful. And it's even more powerful because she ends up suffering for it. They don't live happily ever after. She ends up suffering for it. So we're going to go on in the verses. Going back to Shmot Yudchet, which is where you began Chavrut, I think. Shmot Yudchet. It says there, at the beginning of chapter 18, that after Moshe Rabbeinu takes the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, after the 10 plagues, after the Korban Pesach, after the splitting of the Red Sea, they go through the desert for, let's say, approximately 2 months, 2.5 months. They reach Mount Sinai. And the beginning of verse...
49 days.
Aleph, say it again.
49 days, no?
Minus about a week. Minus about a week.
Okay. 1.5 months.
Okay. Sorry. So the beginning of verse chapter 18, verse 1. Vayishma Yitro Kohen Midyan Chotein Moshe. Et kol asher asa Elohim leMoshe veYisrael amo, ki hotzi Adonai Yisrael miMitzrayim. Bikach Yitro Chotein Moshe Tzipora Eshet Moshe Achar Shiluchaya. And he took, Yitro took, Tzipora, after her Shiluchaha, he took her, Yitro took his daughter and his two grandsons after Shiluchaha, after she was sent away. What? What do you mean sent away? What's going on here? The last we heard, they were at the hotel. She made a grand decision for the family. They cemented the Jewish identity. Moses decided, yeah, we're going to do it together. They go to Mitzrayim to take the Jews out of Egypt. And they went through the whole 10 plagues and splitting of the Red Sea. And they go through the desert for a month and a half, almost two. And they come to Mount Sinai. And suddenly it says, Yitro is coming to Mount Sinai with Tzipora and the two children. Ahal Shiluchaya. What do you mean? We thought she was there all the time in Mitzrayim. So she went with Mitzrayim to Moshe. With Moshe, they came to them alone. And now suddenly she's coming after she was sent away. What's going on? So the Midrash says that right after the incident at the Malon, they got to Mitzrayim, they met Aaron, and Aaron said, you can't bring her into Mitzrayim. It's too dangerous here. We don't need more Jews. We need to get the Jews out of here. You're bringing more Jews in. Send your family, says Aaron to Moshe, send Sipur and the two children back to Midian. That's what the Midrash says. And that's why it says now that when Moses makes it with the Jewish people to Har Sinai, then Yitro comes and brings Tzipora with him and the children. There's no other explanation of how it is that she's appearing now. If we thought she was always here, she must have been sent away. So what it means is, if we put two and two and two together, that one of the first things that happened after Tzipora made this tremendously powerful decision, performed circumcision on her child, in doing so, quote-unquote, converted the whole family to Judaism, and decided that all of them together are throwing their lot in with the Jewish people, and she's going to be the supporter of Moshe Rabbeinu, who's going to take the Jews out of Egypt. Right after that, what happened? She had to separate from her husband, because they said, it's too dangerous for you here. That's really painful. But she makes the decision to throw a lot in with the Jewish people, to allow her husband to become Moshe Rabbeinu, not just Moshe the shepherd, but Moshe Rabbeinu, and almost at the same time, that decision causes the family to break up. A parenthetical break, it's so relevant, because it means that, as we see many times, that people who dedicate themselves to a higher cause have to make a decision between the family and the cause. Sometimes you can't have both. You can't have both. She decided that they're going to become leaders of the Jewish people, and one of the results of that decision is they can't spend time together. She has to go back to Midian. It's too dangerous to raise a family in Egypt. And that's really powerful. She perhaps didn't know all the ramifications of her decision, but it was her decision. The Kli Yakar, a pre-modern commentator, has a very, very powerful insight. He sees the pain of Tzipora. And I'd like to read what he writes. We're at the bottom of page 2. V'kach Yitro Chotein Moshe Tzipora Eshet Moshe. Says that Yitro, the father of Moshe, took Tzipora, his wife, and the two children, and brought them to Moshe as they were encamped at Har Sinai. V'dai lo b'chinam peresh hakatuv shem ishto shmot banav. Certainly not for nothing did the verse explicate the name of his wife and his two children. Why did the verse say her name? She's been mentioned. No, we know what her name is. Why say it again? We know that his wife is Tzipora. Why is her name mentioned? V'zeh ki amar lo Yitro. So why did it mention her name? Because Yitro said to Moses, "Say begin ishtachat Tzipora. Come forth for the sake of Tzipora, your wife." If you remember the verses, it says that Moses didn't just wait in the camp for the family to come to him. It says he went forth to greet them. So in this very, very tenuous interpretation, it's a fanciful interpretation, it's not really written in the verses. This is a real limb but I think it's a beautiful insight. It says that Moses went forth to meet the family because in the message his father-in-law sent with the messenger about to come, the father-in-law said, I want you to come out to meet us for the sake of Tzipporah. She needs you. And that's why her name is mentioned. And says the commentator, the Kli Yakar, that her name is indicative of the reason she needs you. Tzipporah, kitzipor noded mikano, kein ish noded mimikomo. Tzipor, of course, means a bird. She is like a wandering bird from its nest. A man, not a man, this is a male, a person who is wandering from his place. Ubal haskiro tsar ishto. And Yitro was coming by mentioning her name to remind Moses of her pain, of his wife's pain. Kozman heota nodedet mi beta. All the while that she was uprooted or wandering from her home. Remember, she had gone back to Midian, but without her husband, that's no longer her place. He's in Mitzrayim, she's in Midian with her father and family, but she feels herself to be like a tzipor nodeh, the wandering bird. She is living with that pain of being without her family, without her husband, without her framework. Vimlo begina, and if not for her, says the father-in-law, if you're not going to come forth and welcome the family for her, then at least do it for, and he says, Kiulai ein adam margish kol kach betzar ishto. Perhaps you, as a male, don't feel so much the pain of your wife. If you don't feel the pain of your wife, then at least feel the pain of your son. I'm going to cry. Say begin bincha Gershom, then come forth for the sake of your son. Why does the verse say his son's name Gershom, which means a stranger? You can guess what he's going to say. Al shem ki ger haiti beretz nochriya. You gave him that name, Moses, because you said you were a stranger in a strange land. Ubal laskir tsar banim sheinam misubim al shulchan avihem. But Yitro mentions the name Gershom, which means a stranger, to remind Moses that Moses, your own son, has become a stranger. He's living without you. He feels like he's a wandering stranger in no man's land. Because he's not living with you. He's not on Shulchan Avihem. He's not on his father's table. Ki gerim hema, you've made them into strangers. V'amar lo ataya datet nefesh ager. And Moses, you should know what it means to be a stranger, to be wandering, to not have an identity. Look what you've done to your children and to your wife. And I don't think that Yitro is telling Moshe Rabbeinu that you shouldn't become the savior of the Jewish people. But he's telling him, look at the price you've paid. Look at the price your family's paid. Look at what it's done to your marriage and to your married life. It's not easy. It's not easy. We're going to go on, because that's not the end. We're going to go on to the next page, which is the Midrash Tanchuma, to the last part of what we're talking about. It's been a difficult life for Moshe and Tzipora since HaKadosh Baruch Hu called upon Moshe at the burning bush. Before then, they lived a perhaps simple and happy existence. Since the call to Judaism, since the call to Shlichut for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, since the call to Shlichut to save Am Yisrael has come to them, life has been difficult. There have been decisions to be made. There have been moments of hesitation, and there's been separation. But now they're together. Right? Now, from the time that the Jewish people are at Mount Sinai, they're together. And then we come to the verses in Sefer Bamidbar, which seem to have occurred about a year later. We're going from Shmot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, but it's really only a year later. It's really only a year later. And it's Bamidbar chapter Yudbet. Bamidbar chapter Yudbet, which is 12. And it says there, at the beginning of chapter 12, and Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moshe because of the Cushite woman who he had taken, for he had taken a Cushite woman. But to debar Miriam Aaron be Moshe alodot aisha kushit shelakach ki isha kushit lakach. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only with Moshe? Has he not spoken also with us? And the Lord heard it. So we don't have time to explain why the Midrash says what it says, what difficulty in the verse it sees here. But we certainly have time to explain what the Midrash says. The Midrash says that the woman being discussed is Tzipora, Cushite. And there's a verse in the book of Hosea that points out that the Cushites and the Midianites are actually the same Am, the same people. And the Midrashim have different reasons, gematrias, to explain why Tzipora is called the Cushite woman. Doesn't matter, she's the Cushite woman. But what does the verse mean, says the Midrash, when it says that they spoke against Moshe because of the Cushite woman who he had taken, for he had taken a Cushite woman? And as far as I know, the undisputed direction in the Midrash, although this is not necessarily the Pshat, what it's talking about is that they are angry at Moshe for divorcing Tzipora because he had earlier married her. In other words, if you're married to her, why are you divorcing her? There's no hint in the text of a divorce, but throughout the Midrash, in tens of places and in the Gemara, there's an assumption that Moses divorced Tzipora. In other words, they had lived together in Midian for 60 years. And from the moment Moses got the call of God to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, the trouble began. They were in the Malon, the circumcision, they were separated until Yitro brought her back to Mount Sinai. They lived together for about a year at Mount Sinai. I take it back. They lived together at Mount Sinai for a certain amount of time. We'll see later, it was about a week or two or three, not a few minutes. And then there was a divorce. Why was there a divorce? Well, the Midrash is a long story. It's in front of us. We can't read inside because we don't have time. The Midrash says as follows. The Midrash says that at Mount Sinai, if you remember, introduction to the giving of the Ten Commandments, Moses is told by God to tell the Jewish people, separate from your wives for 3 days. There's a certain necessity of purity, certain necessity of spirituality, certain necessity of leaving behind the physical and the sexual and the gashmi in order to receive the Torah. And they do that. And according to the Midrash, and here there's two interpretations, either God tells Moshe, they separated for 3 days, you have to remain separated forever. Or it's Moses says to himself, if to receive the Torah one has to separate from his wife, then me, who's always talking to God, I certainly have to separate from my wife forever. Whether it was Moses' decision or God's decision, in the Midrash it's clear that Moses divorced his wife. By the way, according to the version that he divorced his wife of his own, it says God agreed with him. And Moses was told, you made the right decision. That's the approach we find in many, many, many Midrashim. Which means that they spend a few days together from the time that she is brought to Mount Sinai. But then, from the time the Torah is given, perhaps only a week later, this matter of separation and divorce is instituted. And the rationale is that there seems to be a certain tension, a certain discrepancy between physicality and spirituality. As the Rambam explains it, most Jews and most prophets are supposed to live in this world and have an occasional connection with God. And we're supposed to sanctify the physical world, supposed to be married, supposed to have children, supposed to be involved in not going up to heaven, but bringing heaven down to earth in the physical world. But Moshe Rabbeinu, he's one of a kind. Moshe Rabbeinu is always with God. Moshe Rabbeinu is always with God. Moshe Rabbeinu is married to God. He's married to God. And Moshe Rabbeinu can't be married. And he has to separate from his wife. He's not part of the physical, he's not part of the material, he's someplace else. He's one of a kind. It's not a model for everyone, but he is one of a kind. And I would just like to think about what this means about the relationship of Tzipor and Moshe. I've said it a few times here, just to sum up once again. She decides for him at the Malon that they're going to be part of the Jewish people. But that ends up destroying their marriage on two levels. First, because they were separated when he went into Egypt, because it was too dangerous for her and for the family. His time was completely given over to his shlichut. And then when they finally reunite, it turns out that he has become a man of the cloth, a man of God, so dedicated to God that there's no room, there's no place for a wife and for a family. And she has to bear all that. She has to live through all that. And to me, this is extremely, extremely relevant and meaningful. Because we can't whitewash the facts. The facts are, as far as I understand them, that if you really, really want to dedicate yourself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you really want to dedicate your life to shlichut, to serving the Jewish people, then the family does suffer to a certain degree. There's just no way around it. You might have been told beautiful stories about rabbis and their wives. It's not always true. You know, rabbis are dedicated to the congregations. And sometimes the family suffers. And people who are dedicated to God, sometimes spirituality finds itself in tension with physicality. There's no doubt about it. Life is not so simple. In the case of Yitzchak that we saw yesterday, we saw how dedication to God, being an olat tmima, prevented him from communicating with his wife. That was sad. That was painful. Those things often happen. I take it back, not often. Those things can happen. With Moshe Rabbeinu, we don't see problems of communication. We see problems on a different level. We see first that they couldn't be together when he was in his shlichut in Mitzrayim. It was too dangerous for her, or he had no time for her. And then we see now that when he's completely dedicated to God, there's simply no place.
Yeah.
There's no place for a wife and for a family.
40 days up the top of Mount Sinai.
Right. He didn't even get a drink, and he came down, Karan Or Panavi came down with, he was completely suffused with divine light. He can't relate to the physical world. Again, these are not things that happen every day. The Rambam says specifically, it's one of a kind, it's only Moshe Rabbeinu. But as a modern's idea, these things do happen, these tensions are there, we have to learn how to navigate them. And I would still think that despite the problems, and despite the issues, it's all worth it. The tensions that develop in a marriage and the tensions that develop between physicality and spirituality, well, they wouldn't develop if Moses had stayed in Midian. But life wouldn't have the same meaning. Life wouldn't have the same depth. There wouldn't be the same texture and richness. But once you find that richness of life for Am Yisrael and life with Am Yisrael and life with the Kodesh Baruch and life for Kodesh Baruch Hu, at the same time that these things can add beauty and depth to the relationship between man and wife, they also can add tension, and those tensions, again, I think are worth them, have to be navigated. At the end, in the last minute, I want to say that the Zohar disagrees. And the Zohar says Moses separated from his wife, and that indicates a blemish in his personality. He really should have found a way to stay with God and to stay with his wife at the same time. And that ends up being a question in Jewish theology. Is it possible to be totally with God and totally with the physical world at the same time, like the Zohar says? Or is it that at the highest levels, there's going to be a tension and one has to give? And I'll leave you with that question. Okay.
When we were talking about it too,